Welcome to Pet Food Advisors. I'm Tracy Hotchner, here with my co-host, Dr. Sean Delaney, a board-certified veterinary nutritionist whose company, Balance It, is sought after by pet owners and veterinarians across the world for advice about personalized, optimal nutrition. This show offers well-researched, objective information about pet nutrition, from home cooking to the pet food industry, so you can make thoughtful decisions about feeding your own dogs and cats. This show is a production of Eight Paws LLC and DVM Consulting, Inc., which are solely responsible for its content and are proud to bring you this PSA about the catnip allergy study. Are you allergic to cats? Does your cat or the cat of a friend or family member cause you to sneeze or get itchy, watery eyes? If so, you may be qualified to participate in catnip, a clinical study of an investigational drug combined with allergy shots. Researchers are screening cat allergic individuals at their study sites in Los Angeles, Denver, Chicago, Baltimore, Chapel Hill, Seattle, and Madison. If you're allergic to cats and interested in learning more about the catnip study, go to www.catallergystudy.org. Dr. Sean, I have a topic I've actually wanted to talk to you about for a really long time, which is this claim, this worry, this fear-mongering by all sorts of people, both owners and people in the pet profession or on the fringes of it, that cancer causes, that kibble causes cancer. Kibble causes cancer. And there are people that are actually going around saying this and repeating it and believing it, even though not only is there no science to back it up, there's no logic to back it up. And just this past week, I got a promotional envelope in the mail from a publication that's all about dogs and dog food and training. And the big catch that was supposed to get me to get the subscription was, do you know why kibble causes cancer? Can you believe what they put in these foods? Subscribe now. So I'd rather subscribe to logic and common sense and a sense of thoughtfulness about how we all live our lives and the fact that cancer is pervasive both in the canine world and extremely pervasive in the human world. And there's a lot of things we're doing and a lot of things we can control and can't control that are probably part of why we see this rise. But the fact that people are claiming kibble causes cancer is disturbing to me because it misses the point of things that might be carcinogenic in our environment or in our lives or our dogs' lives. And we're missing the point if we just point the finger at kibble. I'm sure you've heard this too.
I have. So I think I'll take a step back and talk about where I believe this comes from.
Okay, good.
And I think that helps frame it.
Yes.
I think that for some people, they inherently see kibble as unnatural and something that is not the norm. And therefore, it must have a consequence because that's not how things were. And then they go and they have these anecdotal reports about the farm dog that never ate kibble, you know, lived on table scraps and lived to be 20, you know.
Right. And chicken bones thrown in the yard too, I might add.
Yeah, and it lived forever. And, you know, the challenge that I always have with those stories is to say a couple things. One is not every dog develops cancer. So there certainly are going to be lots of anecdotes, even on kibble, where that dog dies of something else. There are dogs that have been on kibble their whole life, and I've seen them that are 18, 19, 20 years old and cats. And so it's not that one is longevity is mutually exclusive with kibble feeding, which is what they're suggesting. Does it increase the prevalence? Well, I think one of the things that's very difficult to tease out is that that farm dog, the likelihood that it had biopsies, chemotherapy, you know, advanced
lung x-rays,
what it had done to it is zero to maybe nil, you know. So I think we have a much higher likelihood of providing a very high level of medical care, of diagnostics to identify and diagnose cancer where it may have been, you know, Fido's just not looking like himself anymore.
Right.
And didn't die of cancer, even if that's what it was. It was just got old.
Yep.
And so I think that there's some, you know, bias in recollection and that plays a role in this. And why I say all this is that if we knew there was some connection, that kibble caused cancer. Let's put those three things together. That I think that there would be a lot of more evidence rather than none. The other challenging thing, and we've talked about this before, is that the whole treatment of cancer, which kind of sometimes treatment gets confused with prevention. That's very common in nutrition. So something that might treat the condition is then believed to prevent it. The classic example is phosphorus restriction. If I reduce phosphorus in the diet, I'll never get kidney disease because I treat kidney disease with phosphorus restriction. Well, the problem is you take a healthy animal and do phosphorus restriction, even like a puppy, that's not going to mean they're never going to have kidney problems. It'll actually cause anemia and other problems. They need to have phosphorus in their diet at the levels that are normal, not levels that are appropriate for when they have kidney disease. So I think when you look at cancer, the struggle is that kibble inherently and historically is a higher carbohydrate meal. And there has been some work that was done by a researcher to suggest three strategies are very helpful. One is low carbohydrate. Another is higher protein, maybe specifically higher arginine, which is an amino acid that dogs and cats require. The lowering of the N6 to long chain N3 fatty acid ratio. But I want to touch upon specifically low carbohydrate. And the reason I want to touch upon that, and I think I've talked about it before, is years ago I was tasked with doing the nutritional management of oncology or cancer or neoplasia, all sorts of different ways of phrasing that. And so being the good new faculty member I was, I wanted to make sure I went to the original source for all the statements I made and went to the citations. And I went to a review article that referenced another article, and I traced back where this low carbohydrate had supposedly been proven to a citation three or four steps back that went to a journal location that didn't exist. And
in other words, the telephone game.
And so I didn't stop there. I had a medical, and we've talked about this before, a medical research librarian, medical school research librarian look in multiple languages. Couldn't find it either, so it wasn't just my ineptness at doing research. And then I went to the next step of actually contacting the person who had done all this, who was subsequently the person that was asked to leave their faculty position for falsifying data.
Ooh, ouch.
And found out that, after a lot of back and forth, I made a mistake. It doesn't exist. And that is the basis and the crux of what everyone that talks about cancer management and low carbohydrate is using. But if you go and look for it and even talk to the person that promoted it, it has never, and I'll repeat, never been shown to work or been proven in any cancer type in the dog. So I struggle with that. And I also struggle with why I wanted to look at that is because the theory behind it is that the cancer cell will be starved of sugar.
Yes.
We all know that sugar or glucose in the blood is used to produce energy and make ATP, which is then drives all the chemical reactions in the cell. Well, if you don't give a cell glucose, it should die, right? And so that sounds like a great idea because we'll starve this cancer cell and it'll die off. Well, the problem is if you feed a dog a zero carbohydrate diet, so no carbohydrate at all, their blood sugars don't drop. And they don't have, hypoglycemia.
Right.
The dog actually maintains normal blood levels of blood glucose. They make glucose out of amino acids and out of fat. It's called gluconeogenesis, one of my favorite words, because you can break it down into what it really says. Glucose or sugar.
Right.
Neo meaning new, genesis meaning creation. So, new genesis or creation of sugar. And so you can make glucose very effectively if you're a dog out of protein and out of fat, and you can maintain your blood levels very easily. And so the blood that's going to these cancer cells isn't stripped of glucose. You don't starve it of any glucose.
Right.
So that very popular theory that is one of the reasons, there's some other rationales, doesn't hold any water because when you actually do, the most severe case of that, it doesn't work. So I think that some of that translates to kibble is high carb. Carbs are bad for cancer. You give low carbs are beneficial for cancer based on nothing. And therefore, we're going to go ahead and think that kibble is a causative factor. Now, you might say, well, kibble leads to obesity, that there's going to be this, issue with, you know, having higher carbs, and we've had these discussions. But what's intriguing to me is that I happened, and we didn't plan this, but I think we may have talked about it in the past, I happened to have a resident who wanted to do a link or look at a link at potentially obesity and cancer risk. And, you know, at the time, my brother-in-law worked with me full-time, and it's going to become significant in a moment. And we decided to go through the medical database of the UC Davis, where I was a faculty member, and look at 20,000 cases. Now, you might say that doesn't seem like a whole lot.
Oh, it does to me when you consider that most nutritional trials on dogs are done with 4 to 6 dogs.
Yeah, I had a chuckle about this recently, and we talked about it last show. I was in Indianapolis, and he was asked, I've done, you know, some projects that had 20,000. I've had projects with, you know, actually more than that a couple times. And I was asked to present my poster orally, briefly, on this particular study that I hadn't been asked before that had 2 dogs in it.
Whoa.
Had 2 dogs. And that was the one they wanted me to present, whereas my previous one had like 20,000, which I just had a chuckle about. I even made a comment about it. Now, not to belittle my, you know, recent work that I just did, but not as powerful. I mean, it was as something where you've looked at that many animals. And so when you do statistics, you really get a good picture of this. And what was interesting about this is that we didn't see an impact of obesity that was clear cut, meaning that you didn't see dogs that were obese being more prone to having cancer. Now, that's an interesting discussion point. And nor did we see the cachexia, which was what everyone's clinical impression is. You know, people who get very wasted away are cachexic, we talk
right.
about. They burn through calories. They have trouble maintaining their weight. We didn't see a lot of that either. And we were looking for it. And we looked also at breeds. And one of the things that teased out is that there is, and this has been shown before, there are certain breeds that are more likely to have cancer. And so if I were someone looking at this, and there's others that are much more clever and oncologists and geneticists, one of the things we have done is we have bred dogs for specific phenotypes. That's just a fancy way of saying specific traits that get expressed by genes, to have them look like a Boston Terrier, like my previous dog,
right.
or my standard poodle, who's my current dog, and which I love, doesn't shed. Well, sometimes when you select for these great traits, and I love my poodle, but there's things that come along with it. Poodles have Addison's disease very commonly, an endocrine disease that JFK had. And so there are certain things that come along with the ride, and we don't know that they come along the ride. And so we pick for a certain trait. I always think that Yorkies are very interesting to me because I deal with lots of Yorkshire Terriers who have shunts. They have problems with the way their blood flows through their intestinal tract and bypasses the liver. And well, one of the things that happens when you have a shunt is you're smaller than normal. So I wonder, is there something that happened a while back when we picked the runt that had a shunt and we put that in?
Yes.
So we get this much smaller dog that looks very cute and nice.
Well, in fact, Yorkies never used to be these tiny, tiny little handful of dog. Yorkie was a full-size terrier. I mean, it was still a small dog, but they certainly were never 4 and 5 pounds, which is now, you see that in urban areas.
Right. And so we now know that we have selected for traits that then come with other things. They're on the same chromosome. They're in the same location. And we now know that there are certain breeds that are very prone. So golden retrievers and boxers, they are just waiting to have cancer. And we know, for example, the golden retriever, it's, I think, 60% of them will develop cancer. And because of that, which you know about, but maybe listeners don't, they've enrolled this very multi-million dollar study, lifetime study in golden retrievers by the Morris Animal Foundation to try to look at causative effects. And certainly genetics is one of the main focuses. And one of the questions is, are the genes that help protect against cancer, are they somehow
bred out of them?
Functional, bred out of them, if it may be the wrong word for us, but basically not working the way they're supposed to, which then leads to this very high incident rate. And so have we, by our breeding and our inbreeding for other traits, increased the genetics for developing cancer? And was that farm dog that who knows had what kind of pedigree, was what we were getting really also not the fact that it avoided kibble, but what we refer to in biology as hybrid vigor. It's one of my favorite phrases. Hybrid vigor is the term that is used when you take different, more distantly related individuals and breed them, their offspring are stronger for it because the recessive genes that they would otherwise had if they were very closely related have been lost. It's why you see the very bizarre royal family, you know, that you know has the, you know, Queen Victoria, you know, hemophilic issues, or
yes.
See them and you look at the, you know, picture of the King of England and the last Tsar of Russia, and they're cousins, but they look like they're identical twins because they just, their genetics are so similar because of all this inbreeding for, you know, centuries. It's just, and so you get bizarre things. You look at the Jewish population, certain sects of the Judaism, they're very, very small, and they have inbred, and they have very bizarre genetics because of it, and they have genetic diseases they have to now test for. And so we've done the same thing by our selection of breeds. And so I would argue that, you know, is it genetics playing the biggest role? Certainly diet plays a role. You know, if you have lots of antioxidants, if you take in certain, you know, cruciferous vegetables, you can reduce your risk of cancer. Absolutely, that can play a role. And there's probably a role to play. But is kibble specifically causing cancer? I struggle to find the connection. And that's not because I'm trying to, you know, somehow benefit the kibble industry or the pet food industry. I just don't think we have the science to support it yet. Now, that lifetime study that I mentioned, they are specifically going to look at nutrition. I know this because I actually was served as a very informal consultant because they were worried about how to collect diet histories accurately for folks that fed a lot of human foods. And so I had a meeting with some of the study designers, if you will, and had a very, you know, discussion because I have a lot of expertise on human foods and how to capture that information and really know what is that someone is actually feeding. And so they sat down with me and I helped with that in their design. Now, I would argue that there are so many variables in that study, and I think you and I offline have talked about that, that I think it's going to be very hard for them to tease apart some of what may be causing the golden retriever to have a high incident. But I do think that what they will get is they're probably going to get some really good genetic data. They're going to know exactly which ones, you know, have what genes being expressed. And, you know, when you look, I went to a presentation at that same meeting, the cost of sequencing the genome, the full genome, has gone from millions and millions of dollars to now in the thousands of dollars a range. And they're predicting it's going to drop even more to the point where it'll be an in-hospital test and you'll be able to do your full genome for, you know, a reasonable blood test cost very, very soon.
Well, one of the things that I was told a number of years ago, there was something at the Jacob Javits Center in the city called Meet the Breeds, which I believe they're still doing. And they'd have a representative of each dog breed. It was very charming little kind of booths. It was to educate the public and introduce them to breeds they might not have known about and might want to meet a breeder or buy a puppy, not at that moment, but down the road. And there was a gal walking around with a golden retriever that looked more like the golden retriever that I had 25 years ago. And the golden retriever look that I recall as a girl, which was not a heavy-coated dog, more like a coat like a Gordon Setter, if you will, and a darker red color, like a chestnut-colored horse. And that's
have become much more blonde.
Well, here's what she told me. This is an English golden retriever, and I said, what's the difference? And she said, he doesn't come from that one stallion, and I think she referred to him as a stallion, meaning a fundamental stud dog from which all others, as in thoroughbred horse racing, one horse, one stud is actually the greatest of grandfathers of horses.
How many horses are we going to get now with the most recent Triple Crown winner, right?
Wouldn't that be great? But in fact, all thoroughbred horses really do come if the tree really does go back. One sire. And in the Golden Retriever in America, at some point in dog showing, which is where a lot of this happens, a very big-headed dog with a very, very, very thick coat, heavy feathering, as it's called, very blonde, to the point of nearly at some point white blonde, not the color of a chestnut horse, won. And everybody wanted that look. And then they wound up breeding to all offspring of that one stud dog. And according to her, there isn't an epidemic of cancer in the golden retrievers in England. Now, that isn't to say that there's not a hideous amount, and I do mean hideous amount of inbreeding in England, because it's an island. And being an island, they didn't let in any dogs until about 5 years ago. So the only dogs on that island of any breed had to have already been on the island, just like their royal family. So inbreeding, interbreeding, line breeding was essential because you couldn't bring in fresh blood from anywhere. Those dogs could leave the country and maybe go to a dog show elsewhere and maybe be bred elsewhere, but then they had to come to 6 months of quarantine, and nobody was willing to do that. So who knows what problems those Goldens may have developed, but they didn't come from this one sire who must have had a heck of a lot of cancer to spread around his brethren.
Or at least not the right genes to help, you know, kill
protect
the cancer cells
it.
When they develop.
Yes.
Yep. One of the two, you know, because it's a combination of how quickly do you have mutation and then how quickly do you identify that and kill it? Because, you know, we all have cells that are doing the wrong thing all the time. Your hope is that the body is killing them off and saying, no, you don't
that's
get to
right.
reproduce without, you know, uncontrollably. And that's where things go wrong, is where that, you know, mutation combination coupled with, you know, the control mechanisms to kill off those cells when they're getting out of control, when they're no longer functioning appropriately.
Okay, so, I want to go back to cancer and kibble because, yes, the low-carb issue is one argument, but there's another argument that I believe is what was being promoted in this Please Subscribe to Our Magazine, which is that the actual ingredients that go into kibble are so foul, so toxic, so carcinogenic, such cancer-causing things are put into kibble that it's little wonder that it's causing cancer. And they refer to, and I've read a number of books and read a number of interviews with people who claim that they absolutely know that at one point there was a claim that euthanized pet animals that had cancer and or were on chemo or not, that those pet animals went into the meat supply of rendered meat products, and or sick animals that had been medicated for it, whether it was chickens or cattle, that their body parts went into kibble, as well as just things that were rotting in the sun and foul from being rotting meat, let's say.
Yeah, so let's talk about each of those. And we've talked previously, the FDA actually investigated the issue of dogs and cats and pet food and did a very exquisite study looking at DNA and, you know, basically couldn't find even a single cat in, you know, tons and tons and tons of pet food that they analyzed because their sensitivity was so high. So, you know, the issue of dogs and cats being in pet food really has not been substantiated. And I don't know, even if it were, I don't know how a dead dog or dead cat, as abhorrent as that sounds, would cause you to then develop cancer. You know, there certainly are diseases that are spread by eating or cannibalism, if you will.
Right, right.
You know, the concern, usually the most classic, is, you know, the worry of like mad cow disease. That's the one that
correct.
We think about in our
correct.
Most with neural tissue from the same species. And then you get these prions that are forming and change your proteins in your brain or your neural tissues. But cancer formation is not one that we're aware of, so it's not like cannibalism is associated with a cancer risk.
That's right.
So that doesn't really explain
or eating
it.
Green, or eating green monkeys, sorry to interrupt, was supposedly the start of the cause of the AIDS virus.
Yeah, so the sensationalism obviously is there, and it derives where, you know, people want to maybe put their own beliefs in poor quality, but, you know, the connection to cancer is not there with that particular example. And then the euthanasia solution concept, the FDA in the same time was looking at Pentobarb, which is the typical
right.
one of the, you know, there's different drugs that are used in euthanasia. There's usually one that is a sedative, if you will. There's one that is actually stops the heart. That's potassium chloride. And those drugs are not cancer causing. You know, one is, you know, potassium chloride is a very common electrolyte. You need potassium chloride.
Right.
And if you eat it, it's what people use when they need to use a salt substitute.
Right.
It just provides a little bit of a metallic-y salt taste, but those are essential nutrients, and they're not cancer-causing. If they were, we would all die because we need them in our diet.
Right.
And so that doesn't fall through. The pentobarb thought process, that usually has liver effects, so it's hard on the liver. You can have liver enzyme elevations, things like that. But it wasn't found by the FDA in any concentration they could identify to suggest euthanasia and euthanasia solution coming in. But even if it were, you know, dogs that are on treatment for seizures, it's not, that I'm aware of, associated with an increased risk of cancer. And they're getting far higher doses because they're having to basically suppress their seizure activity with these, you know, similar class of drugs. So to me, that really doesn't, you know, make sense. I don't know how you would make the connection because, A, it's not present,
right,
and it's given at concentrations that are much higher and doesn't cause the problem. Now we go into, okay, spoiled animals, you know, animals
right.
that are, you know, have gone off.
Right.
So usually the concern with that is rancidity. So rancidity is where the food has been, the fat has oxidized, you get aldehydes, which certainly can be cancer causing, but the concentration of when you won't be willing to eat it, if you're a dog, is usually very, very low, meaning that it's not like you're eating formaldehyde at high concentrations. Now, someone would say, well, maybe there's levels of that that's high enough and prolonged enough and could be a concern. Well, that would be interesting, but no one's ever shown that. You know, I think that if we knew, we've had enough opportunity to say, well, if we have spoiled food that's gone rancid, and the rancidity concern is far greater in the food as made than it is in the spoiled food that you start with, meaning that it's much more likely that a kibble is going to go rancid because it's not been adequately preserved than it's because
right.
you're using rancid fat to start with. That risk factor is much lower, just to be clear. So could their argument be that food shouldn't be shelf stable? Well, okay, I'll give them that, and that would be an interesting argument, but I've never seen anything to support that idea. And certainly you can measure rancidity, and usually pets go off of the food. If you get rancidity and you get high enough levels of peroxide values, is the typical way you test for that, or PVs we refer to it, they won't eat it.
That's right, and I've often had to point out to people that were buying the 40-pound bag of inexpensive supermarket kibble and leaving it out in huge bowls for their dogs, saying, first of all, their saliva is dripping on this food, and that in itself causes degradation of the food. But by the time you get halfway through one of those bags, it's gone off, and that's why your dogs aren't eating, because they know it isn't good. And so dogs, even if they're hungry, won't eat kibble that's gone rancid.
And it's not even necessarily it's going to make them sick. It just doesn't taste as
good.
That's right. And so it's not a sickness. They're just, they're selective, and their sense of smell is so great that they smell those volatile compounds coming off and go, I'm not going to eat that anymore. And I think another comment I would just make about, you know, kibble, I think the ironic comment about your 40-pound less expensive food is that those foods are probably less likely to go rancid than the natural high-end foods, because the natural preservative systems that we utilize in natural pet foods are not as good at preserving the fat. That the artificial preservatives are wonderful antioxidants. And what I mean by wonderful, so people don't get me wrong thinking, oh, I'm a big proponent of artificial preservatives, it's just that if you're measuring your measure of how good an antioxidant is, if it prevents oxidative damage, artificial preservatives wins hand down left and right. That's why they're used. They protect against
right.
oxidative damage far better than mixed tocopherols, which is what usually is existing in a natural preservation system in a natural pet food. And I would argue that a lot of people that might suggest this idea of rancidity, or, you know, that's gone off, would be the first to say, well, then you should use natural pet foods. What I'm saying in contrast to that is that those are the ones that are going to be more prone to it potentially, because you're not using as strong or as good of an antioxidant when you go to a natural source.
Which is why I've always said to people, only buy the size of bag that you will finish within about 3 weeks. Keep it in a food safe PVC kind of container, or in its own bag in a closed container, and you should finish it in about 3 weeks for this very reason.
And I would argue that that's not bad advice, and I think that's really important for a variety of reasons and pests and other things, but I would argue that the better rationale is to use product with a longer shelf life ahead of it, because what's happening with time and the way you look at rancidity is you put an excess of preservative in, whether it be natural or artificial, and then you look to see how it gets exhausted, if that's the right term. So you can actually measure how it's been destroyed with time. And often the way that shelf life is determined, and we've talked about this in the past, is both by vitamin degradation with time and making sure your vitamins are still at the minimum levels you want them to be with time and at the end of the shelf life. And the other is that the rancidity has not gotten too great. And so you're putting extra preservatives in to protect against that, and they're getting exhausted and destroyed with time until you reach the end of the shelf life. And so if you want the greatest luck or success, pick product that has the longest shelf life. And that'll mean that hopefully the highest highest levels of inclusion of tocopherols or artificial preservatives are still present, and therefore the least likely to have rancidity become an issue. And part of the reason I mention that is that I think there are people who perceive or believe that the bag itself is the only protective measure that is being provided to the user. And in fact, the bag does maybe provides some protection, but it usually, and it is very unusual to be actually hermetically sealed. Kibble, if you look for it, usually has a tiny little hole. The bag has a tiny little hole in it, a valve in it, to allow air to go in and out of the bag. So granted, it's not a lot, not like opening right. the big top right. of the container, but it is not sealed like canned food is. And so you're relying on the antioxidants that you put into the dry food to protect against oxidative damage, not just solely your packaging. And your packaging is a secondary and not a primary protection against that, versus a can where all of you have no antioxidants that you're putting. You don't put mixed tocopherols in as a protectant against rancidity in a canned food. You're using the can as a barrier to any oxygen and exchange of air between the environment and the canned food. And once you break that can open, it's going to oxidize and have rancidity issues far greater and much more quickly than you would ever see with a dry food, because you don't add any extra in. So
right.
anyway.
Well said. So just in wrapping up, there is an epidemic of cancer. It's greater in Rottweilers and Boxers and Golden Retrievers and some other breeds, and probably genetic, which would be the most logical proof because they all come from a similar genetic line. But there are many things in the environment that we are exposing our dogs to that we do have control over and we're not considering. So that would be, if you have any kind of a lawn, I very strongly recommend, yet again, to any of you, do not fertilize your lawn with a non-organic fertilizer that also says it has a weed killer. It's absolutely carcinogenic for yourself, your children, and your pets. Now, you are not on your hands and knees and then putting your hand in your mouth the way the pets are on the grass and then licking their paws or licking their legs. So stop doing that. That's carcinogenic. Anything that kills weeds has all kinds of really intense chemicals in it. And that would go for spraying your property. I know way too many people, especially on the West Coast, every month we spray against ants. We spray, oh, I didn't see any ants, but I just like to have them spray poison all around my house. And then they're told it's organic. I'm not sure how organic it can be, but anything that kills other things, be they weeds or insects, whatever it may be, is going to affect animals and children that are close to the ground, breathing it and licking it. So, I mean, those are just two things. The chemicals you use to clean in your house, to clean your floors, to clean your carpet, the kind of flooring you've all read. I hope everyone saw that really disturbing, I don't know if it was 60 Minutes. I believe it was 60 Minutes about the horrible gases that come off of the fake hardwood laminated flooring that's all over the West Coast and many other places. It comes from China, and it is carcinogenic to the max. Makes people sick to be in the house. You have to find out what the particles are that make up the building in which your dog and cat live. I mean, there's just so much going on that is so much more toxic than anything that may have been part of a bag of kibble before it was turned into kibble, which is basically at high pressure and heat turned into a dough, which is then made into a shape and then cooked in various ways. I think you're looking in the wrong direction.
So that farm dog, because of its hybrid vigor, because it didn't get inbreeding,
yep.
and because it was out in the outdoors before lots yep. of chemicals are being sprayed everywhere,
yep.
and because, oh, by the way,
and no stress.
Got a lot of exercise.
No stress. None of the urban stress.
And by the way, it never got diagnosed because you never took it. You just yep. decided to euthanize it or let it go,
yep.
and therefore cancer, even if it had, it wasn't diagnosed, would be our suggestion is, things to at least consider and look at besides just kibble.
Definitely, yes. At the very least, many other things to look at besides kibble, and that connection is histrionic, it's fear-mongering, there's no scientific base to it, it's illogical. And if you spend your time and energy in that kind of negativity and that kind of mindless worry, then you aren't paying attention to things you actually could be doing to improve the quality of your pet's life. And
I think that's the most important.
It is the most important.
Let's focus our energy on things where we can make a difference.
Right. And that have real logic behind them. Dr. Sean, thank you so much. And we will be talking again soon with all of you. Thanks, Dr. Sean.
My pleasure. Great talking to you, Tracy.
The Radio Pet Lady Network is brought to you in part by Spot Platinum, an allergy test to find what in your dog's environment or diet may be causing his scratching or licking. Allergies for which Spot Platinum can make a USDA-approved serum custom-tailored to your dog's specific needs to control his symptoms. Spot Platinum is a privately owned company that has done more than 500,000 allergy tests over 25 years. For more information, visit them on the web at vetallergy.com. We are also supported by Meow Space, a clear ventilated enclosure that can be a one cat feeding space, a litter box station, or even a safe place to nap, designed so that only one cat with a unique access device can enter the see-through box. Meow Space is made in the USA to solve out-of-litter box problems and individualized feeding needs in multi-cat households. Big enough for large cats to do their business or small dogs to eat their own food in peace. Meow Space benefits the whole family because it keeps dogs and small children out of the litter box, too. Go to meowspace.biz. That's meowspace.biz to see for yourself.